Hello, Office Hour listeners. This is Andrew Marzoni on a rare occasion flying solo. Toby could not be here today, unfortunately. But fear not, I will not be alone for the entirety of the podcast. We have a special guest who you are going to learn all about in a moment after our intro spot and musical interlude. So enjoy, be patient, and I'll be back with you momentarily.
He came up in Dallas, had no hazel in his eyes, had them sandals on his thighs, but his lady shone, captivated.
I'm Andrew Marzoni.
I'm Toby Wilson Bates.
And this is The Office Hour. Well, I should begin by welcoming back Dr. Jeff Fallis, who is making his second appearance on the podcast. I think you're the first guest, repeat guest we've had.
Wow.
Off the top of my head, I think.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, no problem. So last time you were here, we were kind of talking about poetry insofar as whether or not Bob Dylan is a poet.
Mm-hmm.
And this time we're going to talk about poetry again, though in a slightly different context.
And in the intervening, however long that's been, 5 or 6 months, Bob Dylan finally accepted his Nobel.
He did.
This weekend.
He did.
So that gives us a point of continuity between
right.
our last conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So one of the reasons that we're talking about poetry today is because Jeff and I are both recipients of this Poetry at Tech Pedagogic Grant, which means that we have both incorporated poetry into the classes we're teaching on the semester in
mm-hmm.
different ways, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But first of all, I have this long kind of dissertation preliminary exam type question that Toby sent me, because Toby is teaching right now, so
okay.
you can join us for the interview.
It's also April.
It's
the
April, which
month,
is National, which
poetry,
is National
month.
Poetry Month. So there's you know, no lack of good reasons to be talking about poetry. So let me read this insane quote and question that Toby gave me.
I didn't know I was going to have to respond to, like, an exam question.
Yeah, okay. Right. I'll do what I can to help. Okay. Happy are those ages when the starry sky is the map of all possible paths. Ages whose paths are illuminated by the light of the stars. Each action of the soul becomes meaningful and rounded in this duality, complete in meaning, in sense, and complete for the senses. Rounded because the soul rests within itself even while it acts. Rounded because its action separates itself from it, and having become itself, finds a center of its own and draws a closed circumference round itself. Philosophy is really homesickness, says Novalis. It is the urge to be at home everywhere. So that was a quotation, as Toby writes. This is Jörg Lukács in his Theory of the Novel. And while his language is poetic to the point of being opaque, what he's driving at here in the larger chapter about epic poetry in contrast to the novel is the way that poetry creates these self-enclosed worlds of meaning. The poem is both the map and the world. It is a way to find something in the thing that is found. Epic poetry, for Lukács, was culture. It was self-defining and self-producing. The word poiesis from the ancient Greek means to create, and Lukács saw poetry as self-creating in the truest sense of the word. So why isn't poetry still a big deal? How come it no longer seems like the go-to place for creation? Or is it, and we just don't understand how it has shape-shifted? Like, is corporate jargon really just crafty POMO poetry repurposed by powers that implicitly understand its world-building power? Is Lukács way off base or more right than he could possibly know?
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Nice to answer that?
Well, I mean, I can help out.
Okay.
I mean, I think this is... This reminds me of a question that one of my students asked me on Monday
mm-hmm.
About after class. He kind of timidly came up to me and he was like, all right, you know, as an academic, someone with a PhD in literature, like, what is your opinion, like, of rap, of hip-hop,
mm-hmm.
right? And, I mean, what I told him is that, like, is hip-hop poetry? Like, yes, absolutely it is. But, you know, it is also kind of a slightly different thing
mm-hmm.
because it exists in a different cultural space.
Yeah.
You know, like, it is poetry, but it's also it's also its own thing, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking back at I'm trying to read this quote again.
Yeah, I think that Toby's explication of it is a little less opaque than the quote itself.
Yeah, the quote itself, right. Which wasn't even sure had anything to do with poetry. But
right.
I listened to it the first time through.
Yeah.
I often try to have this discussion in my classes, but then especially with the poetry at tech thing, where I was purposefully supposed to, you know, embed this in my class discussions and talk
right.
specifically about poetry. And we're going to talk about this book later.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the Ben Werner's The Hatred of Poetry also.
Right. And it, I think part of it is maybe that poetry is, best we can tell, the original form of all literature, you know? And it sort of like predates kind of everything. And it has this kind of starry, to borrow an image from that, kind of reputation, and all the literature, you know, kind of diverges from it. But then the fact that its place in the contemporary world, and maybe for hundreds of years, has been problematic, you know?
Yeah.
I think often we kind of historicize that, and there's this, you know, like whatever, it seems like every 5 or 10 years, there is some sort of, especially in American culture, you know, Jeremiah, like in Dana Gioia's classic, Can Poetry Matter?
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And then like every 5 or 10 years, there's some article, no one pays attention to poetry anymore. It could do this kind of wonderful thing. It used to do this. And looking back of it as some sort of, I don't know, unified world or kind of like sanctified kind of art. And there's a falling off from it. And one thing that I feel like it's hard not to kind of feel that. But I think one thing that was really interesting about the Ben Lerner book that came out last year, The Hatred of Poetry, is how he actually goes, it's always been this way.
Yeah,
and looks back
exactly.
at like Plato and like Cadman's Hymn and some of the earliest examples we have of poetry in English or like reference of poetry in sort of like, you know, like Western culture, and been like, this has always been a problem. It might not just be something about dumbed down America in the last 20 or 30 years or something, you know? So, yeah.
Absolutely. And I mean, at the risk of reading another long quote, I mean, this is something I read for my students the other day, and this is from the Ben Werner book. He writes, "Poetry, what kind of art assumes the dislike of its audience, and what kind of artist aligns herself with that dislike, even encourages it? An art hated from without and within. What kind of art has as a condition of its possibility a perfect contempt? And then, even reading contemptuously, you don't achieve the genuine. You can only clear a place for it. You still don't encounter the actual poem, the genuine article. Every few years, an essay appears in a mainstream periodical denouncing poetry or proclaiming its death, usually blaming existing poets for the relative marginalization of the art, and then the defenses light up the blogosphere before the culture. If we can call it a culture, it turns its attention. If we can call it attention, back to the future. But why don't we ask what kind of art is defined, has been defined for millennia, by such a rhythm of denunciation and defense? Many more people agree they hate poetry than can agree what poetry mm-hmm. is. I, too, dislike it and have largely organized my life around it, albeit with far less discipline and skill than Marianne Moore, and do not experience that as a contradiction, because poetry and the hatred of poetry are, for me, and maybe for you, inextricable." And I think that, like, I think that's interesting for two reasons. Like, one, I can kind of see how, you know, I scribble a little bit, and you do too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the poetic act is necessarily kind of related to failure in a sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
That you're trying to concretely represent a vague notion or something like
mm-hmm.
that, right? And also the act of reading poetry is also similarly an act of attempting to grasp the ungraspable, too,
right?
So there's this kind of automatic frustration that is built into the art of reading or the art of writing poetry.
And I think Lerner's kind of, I guess, overall thesis, maybe I'll oversimplify it, but I guess it's like, for whatever reason, poetry as an art has this, like I said, like transcendent kind of function.
Yeah.
And the problem, and it promises these great things, but then the problem is actual poems themselves, which were always kind of failures. And he sees this kind of, you know, like I said, from all the way to the beginning to contemporary kind of problems with it.
So I mean, to come back to Toby's question here, I think there's two things going on. Like, one, poetry is by definition an outmoded technology in the contemporary world, if only because like there are a lot of new poetries now that aren't poetry, right? Mm-hmm. And there was a time when, as you said, you know, poetry was the only thing, but mm-hmm. before there was literature. But on the other hand, you know, poetry, as Ben Lerner kind of talks about, has always had this certain kind of problem in mm-hmm. terms of its relation to the rest of the world or other art. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what do you think about this? If poetry is not the predominant form of expression, maybe mm-hmm. as it once was in the classical world, like, what role in terms of expression or art do you think it occupies today?
Well, this might tie us back to talking, I guess, about poetry, teaching poetry.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then this is one lesson I gave my class this semester. And I didn't come up with it. Mark Jakic, who teaches at Loyola University of New Orleans. And this was from an article in The Atlantic. And he, I guess, was tired in his classes of trying to come up with definitions of what a poem was or what poetry is. And some of the, you know, he says he would answers like this from the article: a painting in words, a medium for self-expression, a song that rhymes and displays beauty, not satisfactory. And then he was coming up with some sort of exercise in which he would try to get at what a poem was. And so he has students bring an object to class that has some sort of personal meaning to it.
Sure.
They get the objects. They get three prompts. The first one, they write a paragraph about why they brought the item in. The second, they write another paragraph that sort of describes the item empirically, as a scientist might, objectively,
from an
outside standpoint. And then last, they write a paragraph in the first person from the point of view of the item. And so the first two are kind of warm-ups. You can see them as kind of, I don't know, an essay or memoir kind of take on things.
Sure.
A non-fictional kind of objective rendering. But the third one, in which the object speaks in the first person, he was satisfied with that as a poem.
Oh, wow.
And he still had his students write above the third paragraph, poem.
Uh-huh.
And I think I tried it with my students and made a really interesting kind of discussion. And I guess I don't know. I'm not sure if it's a question of what does poetry do now? Is it something different from what it's always done?
Right.
Or, you know, what is a poem? You know, is it poetry's fault? Is it the culture's fault? I don't know.
Right.
I can answer this, right? I think it does. I think you're right. It does, especially American poetry, a bunch of kind of different things. You know what I mean? And in terms of answering that right now, I don't know if I can give like a definitive.
Yeah, no. Kind of and I think it, you know, it comes back to the symptom of what Lerner is talking about too, is the very fact that we're talking about this seems to provide evidence to his thesis that like poetry, for whatever reason, always requires a defense.
Mm-hmm.
In that respect, maybe it's worth thinking about, you know, our job description is not, you know, necessarily to teach literature, to teach creative writing. But I guess in your experience, especially because your background is in creative writing,
uh-huh,
right?
Yeah.
So what is it like teaching poetry in a composition classroom as opposed to teaching other genres? Or, in, you know, how is that different than maybe teaching poetry more in a creative writing context? Like, how do you approach those different tasks in different ways?
Yeah, and it's weird because also something about poetry as an art form. It does seem like people, okay, you might hear a bad song.
Sure.
You might see a really bad movie. Usually most people don't extrapolate out from that and be like, screw the movies.
Right.
Never, the movies are defunct kind of art form. No, I'm never listening to music again.
Right.
But there's something about poetry sometimes
that yes.
I'm not sure what it is. You know, I mean, I think he gives some sort of answer there, but it does seem like people, I don't know, you had a bad experience with a poem or a bad poem, and then the whole art form is kind of wrong. You know what I mean? And like, defunct
in some ways.
So that's always like something we kind of talk about. But I wonder, do you have an answer to that? Like, you know, what does poetry do that other art forms don't, or even that other literature doesn't? Do you have an answer to that?
Well,
because I gave one like
I know, think I
exercise.
Think, I think
and maybe this
thing,
is part of it. Does it do something different with language, with communication, with meaning, or something that we're not used to?
I think that one, especially teaching here at Georgia Tech, mm-hmm. where often our students are not predisposed to liking English or literature as kind of field of knowledge. I think that poetry is kind of the straw man that is used to kind of like justify like why an engineer wouldn't like an English class, right? Because it's too obscure, it's too opaque. That there is, and I asked my students this on Monday, you know, like, how many of you hate poetry and why?
And that's always when I get some of the best discussions poetry, and I'd be like, why do you hate
it? Right, and this is probably, you know, why Ben Werner wrote this book. But one of the most common things that I heard is that often in the context of it being taught to them in high school or whatever, poetry parades to them as a kind of secret knowledge.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they have to put in all of this effort to extract this meaning from a poem.
Yeah.
And often it turns out that, you know, they're wrong. Yeah. And that's not what the poem means, right?
I call it, like, this forbidding, like, literary calculus or something. Like
exactly.
That. And you have to throw this work and then, right.
Right. And it's this, I think it's because there is such they have been exposed to such a hermeneutic, like, emphasis on the reading and the understanding of poetry, that they compare that to learning, like you said, how to do calculus or how to do chemistry or something like that. And it's, like, for them, the rules, the steps involved in mastering that knowledge don't make any sense to them. And I think that is ironic to me because I feel like my experience of poetry is kind of the opposite.
Yeah.
In fact, it is kind of, it's not that you have some kind of narrow path by which to determine what the poem means or like how or whether it should be enjoyed. Yeah.
But the point rather is this insane ambiguity and multiplicity of meanings that never end.
Right, exactly, right? So it's, you know, I think that is what, and a number of my students acknowledge this as well, right, is that for them, they know that is the thing that this complete ambiguity and open-endedness and freedom of expression and thought is what many of them absolutely despise about poetry, while also recognizing that is probably the same thing that a lot of people love about it,
right?
So, you know, in terms of how is this different than the other texts that we read, I think it's that it is the genre that opens up that whole can of worms, right?
And you get the weird sense that anything another genre can do, poetry can also do. You can incorporate and develop kind of all those things, and you can have the same things that a good novel does in a poem. You can get the same thing a good essay does in a poem.
Right.
The same thing that a Shakespeare, you know, a drama, I mean, or a tragedy or a comedy, that can be in a poem, or that is in the form of a poem. So it can kind of swallow up any of those things.
Right. And if you think about, like, you know, the other kind of virtues of poetry, like poetry is the form of writing that is perhaps most praised for its economy, right? And, you know, like,
compression.
To say something as succinctly, you know, as possible. Every word has a precise reason for being there. But, I mean, that's a thing you can say about the best fiction, you know, the best journalism. That's not something that is unique to poetry. But I think I would say, in terms of how it is different than other kinds of texts I teach in the classroom, it opens the door for this kind of negative discussion, this defense, that gets at kind of a lot of the fundamental reasons for why we critique or analyze or interpret any kinds of writing.
Right.
Or, you know, why we write or express to begin with, in a way that working with other genres kind of doesn't as easily lend itself to.
Yeah. And then I think also it's just, and again, I'm not sure if I want to say this is cultural thing or like, but perhaps we're so used to language just being used as this transparent medium by which to convey a meaning. You know what I mean? And with poetry, you don't get that. You know what I mean? Like, you draw so much attention to the word as a thing and to language as this like unavoidable thing. And it uses language in the same way like a painter uses paint, whatever kind of metaphor you want to use, but you can't quite get beyond that. And it draws attention to the sound of a word, the way it appears kind of on a page, you know what I mean? You get this, the thinginess of kind of language. And I think that's tricky for people too, and it makes them uncomfortable, kind of in some way. You know,
yeah.
You're supposed to speak language. You're supposed to make yourself kind of understood.
Uh-huh.
You don't want to think too much about what language is or what words are a lot of times, and for some reason that makes people really uncomfortable.
Well, yeah,
because I guess it seems like you could break down into just like, you know, babble or like incomprehensibility or something like that. And I guess it points back to the necessarily arbitrary nature of language if you really start thinking about it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And like, I forgot who said it, but like, every word was originally a poem. I mean, someone saw something and had to come up with a sound or a word to explain what that is.
And I think that's a really essential thing for students of writing classroom to understand is that, like, yes, like, language can mean, like, it can communicate things, but, like, it can do that in very many ways, right? Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes the meaning of a poem is not important, or mm-hmm. as important as the sound of it is, right?
Right.
And to be able to illustrate that there's kind of a whole onion of different layers to what, like, language can do, mm-hmm. I think is one real advantage of, like, using poetry in, like, a composition class.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of your question, I think your original question 10 minutes ago was something about teaching poetry, like, in a comp class.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Specifically at a school like Georgia Tech versus... Yeah, and I taught lots of creative writing workshops, and I think I always tried to bring that into, like, when I taught, you know, composition. I was often going back and, like, sometimes teaching both in the same semester.
Right.
You know, when I was in graduate school, which would be really weird. But I try to synthesize them, I guess, in some way. And I got this grant, you know, this year to teach poetry in my classroom. I think I always try to do that anyway.
Yeah,
maybe
absolutely.
I made it a little bit more of the part of the actual official curriculum.
Uh-huh.
But I do feel like early in the semester, poems are weird because on some level, they, and this is like, you know, classic, like, new critical thing. If you do like a close reading of a poem, you can do that like in one class period. I think you can learn a lot about things that way. But on the other hand, I'll sometimes avoid it. I feel like because students are so angry about it, it makes them kind
well,
of so
it's,
insecure.
It's, also, yeah. It's like because that is such an, or at least was, or probably is, such an essential part of
right.
humanities or English education,
yeah.
The process of the ideas behind close reading.
Yeah.
Are the very reason that students hate
don't
poetry
yeah,
so much.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like you used to do like a shallow reading. What do you hear in the, you know, but then sometimes I wonder if that's not going, you know, anywhere. But yeah, so I have a similar like ambivalence about the close reading of
right.
the poem. And I do feel like it's behind a lot of the angst about
uh-huh.
it and anxiety behind it. But also it can be really useful to teach
absolutely.
The skills that you want students to do when they read and when they write. With a creative writing class, I was surprised. Some of the last few ones I taught a couple years ago, I even felt like students were not as interested in poetry as they were like 5 years ago or
uh-huh.
10 years ago. Even the students who were self-identifying as, we want to be in a creative writing class.
Yeah.
I still felt some of them were a little, you know, I don't know. And you know, I don't know. I'm not sure how much I buy the like, you were either a poet or you were a fiction writer. But on some level, you could sort of see students sort of self-identifying, and there'd be like four or five students who are
sure.
poets,
yeah.
and they're really, really into things. But I try to work it into the curriculum and make students write poems as part of our discussion of poetry. And I found in comp classes, and I found like that really helps to actually engage with it and not just have to do a close reading of it.
Absolutely.
Know? And so the one exercise, you know, I just gave you was one that we did this semester. For one class, I think we read Gene Toomer's Cain,
uh-huh.
Which is a really bizarre and kind of unique mixture of short stories, prose sketches, poems, and like modernist poems, things that are sort of like prose poems, and then like a long drama
right.
at the end. But I think we did like little imitations of some of the poems to get us into the discussion of the work. But that's kind of where I've been leaning toward, I guess, an experiential model where instead of just talking about poems, we actually try to write some of them and see what we can find out because of that.
Do you find, I mean, how do students react to that? Like, the idea of writing creatively, are they excited about that? Are they resistant to it? Is it a mixture of the two?
I think they're resistant at first, and then once you get over that initial resistance, I feel like most of the time students like it. My belief is that everyone is essentially creative.
Oh, yeah.
And that everyone wants to be creative. And, you know, on some level, I feel like it gets destroyed, you know, by our educational system.
Right.
At some point, I try to get back to that, you know. But yeah, I think there's initial resistance, uncomfortable. But if you make everyone kind of do it, then it goes along better, I think, you know. So the resistance will be then once they've actually written a poem, getting them to share it in front of the rest of the class.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But then the other one, yeah, the one I did last semester, which I just wrote about for textile, we read 1984 by George Orwell, and we had been talking a lot about Newspeak, the, like, compressed, radically kind of truncated version of the English language in that book. But its purpose specifically is to narrow the range of kind of possible thoughts. Everything must be acceptable, you know, kind of by the party. And then it was kind of a sadistic idea. Like, I had some good creative writing exercises, I think, when I was, like, an undergraduate and in grad school for creative writing that were, like, almost impossible to complete. And I feel like those can be very useful.
Yeah.
And this one was to write a poem in Newspeak.
Uh-huh.
And that was all I told my students. You can either do a translation of an existing poem, because there's a interesting, you know, because it almost seems like once you read about Newspeak in the world of 1984, it seems like it would make poetry impossible.
Sure.
You know, I mean, if you have something which you're eliminating the range of thought, you know, and it's supposed to almost eliminate individual expression, it seems like poetry wouldn't have a place in the world. But there's a character in there, Ampleforth, who's a poet. He's translating, like, Kipling poems and I think Shakespeare poems into Newspeak. And there's still a weird place for it in the world. I don't know if Orwell couldn't get rid of it yet. So I think because of that, I was like, well, let's try this and see how it goes. And I had my students write what to me seemed impossible, but most of them took to it pretty well. And we wrote poems in Newspeak. I don't know. I'd say probably 3/4 of my students did translations. A quarter tried to write original stuff. But the results were fascinating.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And on some level, Newspeak did what it was kind of supposed to and leveled everything out. Kind of
oh, yeah.
The middle somewhere. But that was really interesting because we were able to kind of talk about multiple things, about language and about is there room still for poetry and individual, what the connection between language and thought was, I guess. So that was probably my most successful and or sadistic experiment with writing poetry so far at Georgia Tech.
You know,
and initially, the students were super resistant, seemed kind of angry.
Yeah.
But then once they actually tried it and we got to the next class period, they actually were, it was, I think, fun for them.
This is completely random, but it reminds me of this episode of Seinfeld where George Costanza starts using abbreviations for everything. Have you seen that episode?
I don't think I have.
Okay. Right. But I can't think of a specific example, but he kind of creates this new language where, like, instead of saying, like, every syllable of a word, he'll say, like, the first syllable or the second syllable or something like that. And the joke, of course, is that he's doing it to be more efficient and to save time. But the process of having to explain what he actually means takes more time than it would have if he just said the whole word.
Right.
But it's funny to think about that as itself a kind of poetry.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. And it just, so, like, in kind of conclusion, coming back to Toby's original question, which I don't think we're going to really answer, and that's fine, but he introduces this possibility that maybe, you know, contemporary corporate jargon could be seen as some kind of, like, postmodern poetics or something like that. Is there some kind of contemporary form that is not poetry that you see as kind of being like poetry?
I got tipped to just go, the text message.
Right, like, yeah.
But I was thinking, like, that was one, when we were studying 1984, I had a student who was just got really disturbed by Newspeak and the abbreviations. She was like, I feel like I text kind of already in this way with my friends and we have this shorthand.
Sure.
And she was like disturbed about what that meant about like the quality of communication and language and so forth that she was engaging in. But yeah, I feel like all this is like too cynical.
Yeah.
And I don't want to do it.
Right.
You know? And I do feel like that kind of thing of just like, you know, advertising jargon. I mean, they might overlap on some level, but
yeah.
I don't know. I still feel like, and maybe this is part of what Lerner talks about in the book, like something does still adhere to poetry for better or for worse.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you know, it's at weddings and funerals, poems are still read.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's just this like outdated, archaic inheritance or something. It still seems like it has meaning for some people, you know? And so I don't know. I still think it does have a place, but maybe our expectations for it are kind of too great, you know. I felt like in the last couple of years there have been times when I felt distant from it, you know, and then like there are times I do hesitate to teach it, because I think some, you know, my most painful experience as an early teacher, someone who loved poetry and was deeply immersed in it.
Yeah.
And my first experiences trying to teach it to students was like, oh, this is reviled. And I felt like personally hurt by like students' reactions to like
right.
certain poems or assignments or things.
But no, so, and yeah. I mean, that is an excellent point, right? Is that in all, you know, despite our eagerness, our culture's eagerness to dismiss poetry as some kind of outdated or elitist thing or something like that, it is like constantly present, mm-hmm. you know, in our lives, and I can't see that going anywhere.
Yeah.
You know?
This might be completely irrelevant at this point, but just I was thinking about like poetry notoriously difficult to define.
Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, I gave you the assignment, you know, to an object speaking in the first person. That
sure.
was like the closest this guy could get to what a poem was. But also my favorite definitions of it are physical and like grounded in the body,
uh-huh.
you know, and like sort of Emily Dickinson's, when I read a poem, it's like the back of my head has been blown off, you know? And then I think it was A.E. Housman said, when he reads a poem, it's like the razor kind of bristle, like makes the hair stand up on the back of his neck.
And yeah.
I think Allen Ginsberg has like one that's similarly kind of physical and almost grounded in this like experience of like surprise and like shock. You know what I mean? And it registers viscerally. And I'm really fascinated by that.
No,
I feel like most people, and it's weird because I felt like a lot of times when I actually push back the students who were saying they hated poetry, and often for the same reasons you did, there would be some poem they liked, or if you broaden the definition of poetry to include like Dr. Seuss or like
sure.
song lyrics or something like that. They didn't really hate all poems. They were just something about it as an abstract that was painful.
If you think about the way the capabilities the poetry has of signifying in a non-hermeneutic way, like the sound of a poem can be its meaning, or in the case of, you know, like visual poetry, like sometimes it's about how it appears, right? It is a form of literature that kind of relies on the other senses in a way, and that's why it would make sense that, you know, the definitions of it that appeal to you most are rooted in the body somehow.
Mm-hmm.
It's perhaps a more purely aesthetic experience mm-hmm. or something like that.
Yeah.
But hey, man, this is a great conversation, and I'm glad we got to talk about poetry some more. We should do it again soon.
I agree.
Alright,
that's
all, man. Thanks. The Office Hour is produced by Andrew Marzoni and Tobias Wilson Bates, Burton Fellows in the Writing and Communication Program at the Georgia Institute of Technology. To find out more about the topics discussed, see our page at textile.lmc.gatech.edu. Thanks for listening.